The American History Podcast, Episode 10, Puritan Relations with the American Indians.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Hello. Thank you very much for listening to the show, and let me just say I greatly appreciate your support. It is currently September of 2022, or very late in September. Now, originally this episode was released way back in the late winter of 2018. Then I tried to redo it in the summer of 2020, and for some reason the episode was all messed up. I don't know what happened. But once I was made aware of it, I pulled that down, and I was not actually able to go back and fix it up until now. And honestly, that episode being messed up is kind of what has led to this whole thing of me putting season one and its conclusion on Patreon only. Now, back in 2018, I was still learning the podcasting ropes, so to speak. Now, I know, I had been teaching and publicly speaking for years at that point, for well over a decade. However, I have to say, speaking to an audience is far different than speaking to a blank wall. Now, believe it or not, it took me a bit of time to get my bearings, and I don't even know if I've got my bearings yet as of today. But I've also, since those early days, hired a sound editor to clean up the recordings and to do the things that I just don't have the knowledge or the time to do myself. Now, anyway, as 1983 was winding down, and I mean the show, not the year, I decided to do two things, as I mentioned earlier. First, I would remove all of the first season from the public stream and make those episodes available only on Patreon. And the second thing I decided was to finally go back and finish the story of colonial America. Now, just as I noted back in the recordings of these original episodes in 2020, this episode will be just as it was originally written. Since this is the last of those, it will start off the way it did back then. Okay, so here we go. Welcome back. This is episode 10, and we are just about ready to wrap up our first season here at the American History Podcast. Again, I want to thank you for listening to the show. I'm truly shocked that more than just my wife and my mom and dad are listening to the show. Actually, the funny thing is the wife doesn't listen to it at all, and neither does my mom or dad, partly because she hears me pontificate on history all the time, and she edits my papers for grad school. So you guys are all appreciated, and I hope to continue the show for as long as you'll have me. As always, please go to iTunes and give us a good review or just rate the show. Those good reviews and ratings help to attract new listeners, and they help those interested in American history find us. Now, before we delve into the relations between the Puritans and the American Indians, I just want to mention a few important points. Remember that New England was made up of more than just the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Don't forget you had Connecticut, New Haven, and Rhode Island. So when I'm referring to the MBC, you can assume that I am including Plymouth in there, unless I directly mention Plymouth. And the second thing is that what you will learn today is probably going to be a bit shocking and controversial. The conventional wisdom amongst the lay person here in the United States, and even amongst historians who do not study the Puritans, is that they were evil, two-faced jerks who only desired, whose only desire, I should say, was to exterminate the heathens. Now, as historian Tom Woods points out, part of the reason for this is the fact that textbook writers have essentially ignored a lot of the recent research, which gives us not only a better understanding of the subject, but casts the Puritans in a better light. And that's actually par for the course when it comes to textbook writing. Now, when they update a book, if you don't know how this works, they make minor changes, and what changes they do make really depends on who they get. So, for example, if they ask me to update a chapter, those updates will not focus on, just as an example, gender, as I am not into gender history and I don't study it. So I'm not up to date on those things, and thus the chapter would reflect that. In essence, the historiographical record is split. On the one hand, you have those who don't specialize in Puritans continuing to perpetuate the one-dimensional, hostile portrayal of the Puritans. Now, on the other hand, you have the specialists who focus on the Puritans, people who write for the professional journals who have been more sympathetic to them. An example is Alden Vaughan's work, New England Frontier, Puritans and Indians, 1620 to 1675. In this work, Vaughan argues that the Puritans were not as hostile toward their native neighbors as they were portrayed, or as they are portrayed, in the conventional accounts. On the other hand, you have works like Francis Jennings' The Invasion of America. Now, this one puts the work in a most negative light possible. The problem with the latter is that the author admits to not having evidence for some of his claims and blames the Puritans for having destroyed the evidence. Now, while that might be true, we can't make judgments based on evidence that does not exist. You have to go with what you've got. So, what I'm going to talk or go with is the Vaughn account, mainly because I think you hear the Jennings side often enough or so often that this argument will help act as a corrective and balance out the narrative. Now, just some background. In 1616 and 1617, epidemic diseases decimated the population in the New England area. Thanks to that epidemic, which we mentioned in episode 9, that area had a population of less than 20,000 natives. Thus, the epidemic totally destroyed the indigenous population and left many groups isolated. Now, the Puritans, in their commentaries on the Indians, don't harshly condemn the natives, but they don't exactly lavish them with praise either. In their words, it's a mixed picture. They do freely acknowledge the generosity and kindness of native peoples. One criticism that they offer is that of Indians as lazy drunkards. Now, on the other hand, they note that the women were very hardworking. They did backbreaking work in and around the household. As for the men, they tell us that during hunting season, they were also very hardworking. So the accusation that the Puritans simply hated the Indians and always looked down on them is spurious at best. The difficult part is the accusation of drunkenness. Indians, in their own testimony, accused themselves of being drunkards. And remember, they did not have the equivalent of strong drink. The Puritans did not believe that it was wise to simply distribute alcohol to the Indians, since the natives had never experienced alcohol before. Now, one more thing on this. The natives, lived at the subsistence level, equal to that of the Stone Age. This isn't a criticism, it's just a fact. And because of this, the Puritans felt that it was wise to keep alcohol and weapons out of the hands of native peoples. In the case of the weapons, this was a command of the king that they were simply upholding. Now, contrary to common perceptions, the Puritans did try to keep their own people from mistreating the natives. Of course, you probably take the statement with a great deal of skepticism, and that's understandable. It goes against everything that we've been taught, so you're probably thinking that I'm either insane or just making this up. And I understand the skepticism, but the documentary evidence is substantial. Just one example is Thomas Morton, who in 1629 came to New England and wanted to take an Indian canoe. He fired a round of hail shot, took the canoe, and ran away. He also, in this encounter, injured an Indian besides stealing their property. Now, he was arrested, and the authorities ordered him to make restitution. What ended up happening is that they confiscated and sold his goods to defray the cost of shipping him back to England and pay the Indians for their canoe. His house was burned down to the ground. Furthermore, in 1633 through 34, during a terrible epidemic, the Puritans did aid the natives and even took in orphans whose parents had died due to the illness. So, again, the idea that the Puritans hated all Indians and wanted to just wipe them out is not quite correct, to say the least. Now, there is another area in which the so-called conventional wisdom differs from the historical record, and that is the idea that the Europeans, in this case the Puritans, stole the land from the natives, or they tricked them into giving up the land. It does not hold up in light of the evidence, and as far as I can tell, specialists in the field would laugh at you for promulgating that idea. Yes, there were instances where Europeans did treat natives unjustly, no doubt. But you can't make a blanket accusation that it happened in all times and all places. It's ahistorical and just plain wrong and unfair to the Puritans. Thus, what I'm saying is that, as far as what I've read, it's correct to say that the Puritans gained land through voluntary secession and both sides understood the terms of the agreements. Now, there will be cases where the Indians are treated horribly, and I'll talk about that momentarily, but on this issue of property exchange, the conventional wisdom is just plain wrong. And look, I understand why people believe this stuff. We have this negative view of the Puritans as hypocrites. And it is true that the Indians started off with all of the land, and then they ended up with little or none of it. So it's easy to think that the Indians were tricked, they were duped, and they were just given worthless trinkets in exchange for the land. But remember, the Indians aren't stupid, or they weren't stupid. They were not going to just give up something if they didn't gain something in return, something they valued more than the land they were trading. The idea that they didn't understand private property and only believed in communal land when talking about the Indians the Puritans dealt with, it's also completely false. Anthropologists have not found any Indians in colonial New England who didn't understand the concept of private property, anthropologists and historians, nor have they found any who held land in common. Further, the deeds are quite detailed and appear to be on the up and up. So this brings me to the question, how did the Indians perish? Well, about 15% died in wars between Indians or with the Puritans. The rest died in wave after wave of epidemic illness. Ironically, the more the Puritans tried to help the natives, the worse the epidemics got. Remember, the Europeans are exposing the Indians to germs and disease. So Indians who went to schools that were set up by Europeans, such as Harvard, were decimated. You also should understand that, materially speaking, the Indians were quite poor. They were, however, land rich. They had way more land than they could ever want or use. They traded what they had for what they didn't have, but wished they did. So I ask you this, who are we to stand in moral judgment of the Indians for trying to improve their livelihood? Who are we to condemn them for trying to make their life better in any way they could? Maybe they preferred having a metal knife or a hoe and trading land for these things. Finally, the Indians in Connecticut Valley, in the Connecticut Valley region, the Indians approached the Puritans wanting to trade. What I'm trying to say is that these things are far more complex and colorful than the conventional narrative. It's not quite as black and white and cartoonish as, say, your eighth grade teacher made it out to be, or as Hollywood often makes it out to be. Thus, having said that, let's look at the dark side of Puritan relations with the Indians. Now, the first event that I want to discuss is the Pequot War, which took place from 1636 through 1637. Now, this war pitted the Pequots against the Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Plymouth and Saybrook colonies as well. Now, I should note that the Puritans had native allies, specifically the Narragansett, and the Mohegan tribes. Relations between Puritans and Pequots were strained in the years preceding the war in the Connecticut River Valley. The Pequots were expanding their area of control to the detriment of the Wampanoags, the Narragansetts, and the Algonquins, as well as the Mohegans and even the Lenape. Now, the war had its origins in a series of disputes over the fur trade and who would control it. Now, if you don't know it, fur was a very valuable resource in those days. In addition to the tensions, an Englishman named John Stone, a privateer, and his crewmen were murdered in 1634 by the Nyantics, a group of natives who paid tribute to the Pequots. Now, while the war was fairly short, lasting only 2 years, the effects on the Pequot were calamitous. By the end of the war, the Pequot tribe had been devastated, and the war ended in an agreement known as the First Treaty of Hartford. The agreement called for the Pequots to submit themselves to the authority of the Mohegans and the Narragansetts. Now, some of the enslaved were shipped, were enslaved and shipped to the West Indies, while some were forced to become household slaves in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Finally, the Pequots were declared extinct, and the Pequots could no longer use the name Pequot. Before we move on, I should note that Vaughn argues that the war was not solely the fault of the Pequots. The escalation of violence came about because of the actions of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and until they escalated that violence, negotiation had been a possibility. Now, in the aftermath of the Pequot War, the New England colonies realized collective security was needed for future defense against the Dutch, the French, and especially the American Indians. Thus, the New England Confederation was founded in 1643. And this was a short-lived military alliance made up of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Plymouth, Connecticut, and New Haven. The significance was this is the first milestone on the road to colonial unity. It was an exclusively Puritan alliance, and it helped solve intercolonial problems such as runaway slaves and criminals. The colonists drew up Articles of Confederation and declared the purpose of the Union to be, quote, a firm and perpetual league of friendship for offense and defense, end quote. Each colony would elect two commissioners to meet once a year and on special occasions. These men had the power to declare war, make peace, and allocate military expenses amongst the colonies based on population. They could also make recommendations to specific colonies, settle any boundary disputes which arose, and provide for the capture of fugitives, for example, runaway servants. There was no executive, and finally, all of the commissioners had to be Puritan church members. The next major war was King Philip's War. This war was fought between the New England Confederation and the Indian chief Metacom, sometimes referred to as King Philip. Metacom was the Wampanoag chief and the son of Massasoit. The war lasted about 3 years, and about 52 of the 90 existing Puritan towns were attacked, with 13 destroyed. This was a particularly brutal war for that time period, and the American Indians copied the same Puritan tactics of attacking non-combatants that they had seen in the Pequot War. Now, in the end, the colonists were the victor, and once again, many Indians were sold into slavery and shipped out of the colony. This was a virtual death sentence, as Native Americans were not able to adapt to live in slavery and often died, either because they were worked to death or from disease. Others were simply set ashore on deserted coasts and abandoned to their fate. Now, while it may appear that everyone in New England approved of such harsh treatment, this is not the case. One of the heroes of the war, Captain Benjamin Church, amongst others, objected to this barbarous treatment of their vanquished foes. Unfortunately, objections did nothing, and harsh treatment was the order of the day. Further, Metacom himself was executed, and his head displayed for 20 years. Finally, other effects of the war include, first, a massive death toll, which was approximately 1,000 colonists and 3,000 Indians, making it the bloodiest war ever fought on New England soil. Further, 20 towns in New England were totally destroyed, and half were severely damaged. The economic expense was also intense, as the war debt for Plymouth alone had been estimated to be greater than the total valuation of personal property of the colony at that time. Second, Native Americans were effectively removed from the NBC, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Having said that, conflict continued in northern New England for decades. The five tribes in the region of Acadia created an alliance with New France, and over the next 74 years, there were six wars between New France and New England, with their respective Indian allies as thrown in for good measure. Third, the success of the NEC was, according to historian Jules Lepore, the start of a separate American identity, separate from that of Great Britain. Finally, the success of New England and the New England Confederation caught the attention of the British Crown, seeking to cash in on the success of the region's colonies. So to conclude the episode, one can see a couple of characteristics of American warfare starting to form. First, Americans, by 1700, in New England at least, we see the germination of what would become the American way of war. Attacks on non-combatants were seen as okay, and to some extent, this telegraphs the development of the idea of total war. This sort of warfare might have been exclusive to use against native peoples in the 17th century, but by the 19th century, the forces of the Union would engage in total war against the Confederacy. Further, slowly but surely, the Americans are not only developing a separate identity from that of the British, but they are also developing an identity that is seen as the opposite of the native peoples. Lepore notes in her book, The Name of War, that by the late 17th century, there was a fear amongst the colonists in New England of being contaminated by natives, and this theme would continue throughout the next two centuries or so. Okay, so I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Now please remember to head over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a moment, drop a 5-star review. If you have any questions, feel free to email me at sean@theamericanhistorypodcast.com, and it's S-H-A-W-N. You can also find me on Twitter at AmericanHisCast. Until next time, have a great day. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.